This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
We have at least 60,000 killed in Khartoum State. The US, the former US Special Envoy, put the number of deaths at 150,000 as of, I believe, July last year.
It is to do with imperialism. We've seen the United Arab Emirates, not just in Sudan, but in much of Eastern and Southern Africa now, try to expand themselves in terms of political influence, but also economic influence.
Sovereign media editor Ahmed Caballo is Sudanese. He explains Sudan's agony after 2 years of the civil war that is just as much a proxy war. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. After 2 years of civil war, Sudan is now the site of the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. However, as in most conflicts in the global south, colonial and neocolonial history are a large part of the story. Weapons go in from more powerful nations while resources come out. Sudanese scholar and journalist Ahmed Caballo, editor of Sovereign Media, broke it down for Pacifica and Black Agenda Report. Ahmed Caballo, thank you for joining Pacifica Radio and Black Agenda Report.
Thank you for having me. Big fan of your work, big fan of Black Agenda Report.
Okay, let's start with how dire the humanitarian situation is. I think it's the worst in the world now. Tell us how bad it is.
Yeah, it's officially, according to the UN, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the world's worst displacement crisis. I think the latest number is over 13 million, probably more than that, displaced, internally and externally displaced. Over 6 million people are at stage 5 famine, which is the most severe case. We have at least 60,000 killed in Khartoum State. The US, the former US Special Envoy, put the number of deaths at 150,000 as of, I believe, July last year. So, of course, there are more people that have been killed. The amount of different ways people are dying with cholera, people are dying via dengue fever. Of course, they're being killed by drones, by artillery, by gunshots. Some are being, as we saw in Al-Fashir, some people have been hanged by their arms and left to just hang there and die that way. It's an atrocious case that until recently was completely ignored. The mainstream media love to call it the forgotten war, but forget is a passive word. Yeah, yes. I forgot my keys. No, it's ignored. People know it's happening, but for some reason have chose to ignore it and not give it the rightful attention, especially because of how dire the humanitarian situation is. And it doesn't seem to be letting up anytime soon. The things that people have been forced to eat, insects, cow food, anything they can get their hands on, grass, hay. We won't really know the scale of how bad everything is until this war is over, because still people can't report what's going on in the same way they can in other conflicts, because in many cases the enemy is right there. So even Al-Fashir, which is the reason why so many people are talking about Sudan right now, the only reason we know what happened in Al-Fashir is because these, I can't think of a better word, but I'll just, these foolish RSF soldiers film themselves.
Yeah.
Had they not filmed themselves, the conflict would still be being ignored. People still wouldn't know how bad it was. People still wouldn't know the grave humanitarian crisis that's going on.
Yeah, and thank you. I should say here that the best source for this that I know of is Sovereign Media, your outlet. I was just reading it. I want to tell everybody to read Sovereign Media, great new outlet. Ahmed is the executive editor, and I believe it's sovereignmedia.online.
Yes.
Sovereignmedia.online. You get, if you just type Sovereign Media, there are a number of things you'll get. So it's sovereignmedia.online. And I've just been reading what is there about Sudan, and that's where I saw the videos. I had heard about these videos, but there's some of these really disturbing videos of RSF violence there. You and others had this very successful campaign on social media to talk about Sudan. So have you noticed a difference since you did that campaign?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily because of any campaign. I think, like I said, it's because the RSF soldiers committed the biggest own goal by filming themselves. Had they not filmed themselves, not just filmed themselves, they filmed themselves and then went on podcasts. So there's this UK RSF supporter who, for the life of me, I can't understand why he's not been arrested. He's based in Sheffield. Daytime, he's an Uber driver. And at the nighttime, he does these lives promoting RSF, and he has very good links with the RSF. He got one of the RSF commanders that's in these videos on the live after the Al-Fasha massacre and asked him, how many people have you killed? And he says on the podcast, I've killed 2,000, but my plan is to start again from zero and get to 2,000 again. Yeah. So if it wasn't for these foolish guys incriminating themselves, then no one would know. But yeah, they keep. I can't figure out why they keep filming themselves doing these things. Maybe it's to terrify. I guess it's you can ethnically cleanse an area through violence, but also fear can ethnically cleanse an area. So what we've seen in Baba Nusa that. Before the RSF arrived, a lot of people left out of fear. So maybe they're filming themselves to literally terrify the civilian population so that they leave before they even get there. Because what we're seeing now is they've started to relocate some families that are affiliated to the tribes associated with RSF into Al-Fasha from neighboring Chad, from neighboring Central African Republic. And they weren't able to do that unless the whole Al-Fasha community was cleansed from the area or had left the area. But yeah, it's I'll give people the benefit of the doubt of not talking about it in a political sense, because it is a little bit complicated. We have a militia that was born out of the army now fighting the army. So it kind of looks like you can understand how people can just dismiss this and say it's a civil war. It's between two factions of the army, essentially. It's not really anything to do with imperialism. I'm not going to talk about it. Right. However, obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. It is to do with imperialism. We've seen the United Arab Emirates, not just in Sudan, but in much of Eastern and Southern Africa now, try to expand themselves in terms of political influence, but also economic influence. So we see that they've got this company called Blue Carbon, sits on the board of the Blue Carbon, is a member of the UAE royal family. And Blue Carbon right now is buying up forest and arable land throughout Africa, not just in Sudan, but Zambia, Liberia, Kenya. And they're buying this land and using that to offset their carbon credits. Secondly, the UAE imports 90% of its food. Yeah, it doesn't have cattle, doesn't have arable land of its own. It relies heavily on the oil industry. But in the next 50 years, the next 100 years, the price of oil won't be what it is today. So the UAE is desperately trying to diversify its economy through agriculture, through gold. It's the second largest exporter of gold without a single gold mine being in the UAE. Through control of the Red Sea, which we've seen in recent years has become even more closely a contested zone. So it sees the model of development that the Western imperialist nations took, you know, as much as they talk about good governance, it was imperialism why we see Belgium as where it is today, why we see France of where it is today, why the UK is where it is today, why the US is where it is today for the looting of Haiti and the countries in its so-called backyard. Canada, Canada has extensive mining network here in Africa. It's imperialism. And these petty imperialist states recognize that to really join the big boys, we need to step up our imperialism game. And that's exactly what the United Arab Emirates does. And that's why it's backing the rapid support forces to the hilt, using the supply routes through Chad, using the supply routes through Uganda, allegedly also Ethiopia to get weapons into RSF-controlled areas, but also to get gold out of these areas to UAE, where they find themselves in Dubai, where the who's who of the Gulf Arab states goes there and buys their wives these nice big bracelets and earrings and necklaces.
So you just established the UAE as one of the principal aggressors here, maybe with larger imperial powers behind it. The UAE seems to be buying up much of East Africa at this point, and to have all sorts of East African heads of state at its beck and call. You've named Uganda, Kenya, which are the other ones? Chad.
Chad,
Okay.
South Sudan until recently, but Buhan visited South Sudan, and I think there's been an agreement reached.
I would add Rwanda. The UAE has enormous influence in Rwanda. And in 2018, the UAE reported importing five times as much gold from Rwanda as Rwanda reported exporting in total.
Yeah, I
So,
wouldn't be surprised about that. I'm unaware of Rwanda's role in Sudan, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was a report that Rwanda is involved as well.
yeah.
But yeah.
Well, they're definitely involved with the UAE and beholden to the UAE at this point. So, if we've gone to the RSF and it's backing by the UAE, can we go back and try to explain the two forces who are fighting, the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces?
Sure. So we can go back all the way to the 80s, but for the sake of time, we'll start in the early 2000s. Sudan under Bashir was ranked as having the biggest disparity between the capital city and the periphery regions. Yeah. So there's other countries. South Africa ranks highest in terms of inequality between the haves and have-nots. Nigeria has the most people living in extreme poverty, but Sudan held the title of the biggest differences between the regions. So people would say that actually the capital is the state. Else, once you get outside Khartoum State, there really is little development, little roads, very little investment in schools, infrastructure, hospitals, etc. So of course that is a recipe for disaster, especially when you add to it political marginalization. Most of the levers of power come from those that live by the River Nile in Khartoum and the surrounding areas. So there was grievances in the peripheral regions, very legitimate grievances. Of course, the largest grievance came from South Sudan, because when Sudan became independent, I think there was one southerner included in the governance of the post-colonial state, which is obviously completely unfair. So there's been grievances, and the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement was an attempt to represent all of these marginalized communities. And obviously this concerned Khartoum. So while it was fighting the war, the Sudanese army was fighting the war with the South Sudanese People's Liberation Movement. They employed militias to do their fighting for them in places like Darfur. Yeah. So they used historic grievances between nomadic tribes, which self-identified as Arab, and then settled tribes, which self-identified as African, and pitted them against each other. Of course, because the regime in Khartoum also consists of people that self-identify as Arab, there was a natural allegiance there and a natural group that they could side with. So when there was an uprising in Darfur, to quell the uprising, they started to arm those nomadic Arab tribes who felt like they were being restricted from their grazing rights, which is also linked to the desertification of the African continent anyway. Climate change, the desert moving further south. So there's always going to be more conflict. And we're seeing the same in Nigeria between the nomadic tribes and the settled tribes about who can graze where. My family have grazed here for centuries. Why can't I now? Et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, they armed a group called the Janjaweed, which was an Arab nomadic tribe. They gave them weapons and they basically encouraged them to settle their grievances with these African tribes. So that's where the genocide claim came from in 2003 against the Sudanese army and the militia. That's where it started from. And then they started to use this militia kind of as a group that could commit atrocities, but the Sudanese army could try distance itself from. So when there was an uprising in Nuba Mountains, again, they sent the Janjaweed. When there was an uprising in Brunei, again, they sent the Janjaweed. And then I think in 2012, I believe it was, might be getting that year wrong, they tried to professionalize the militia and they changed it into what we know as the Rapid Support Forces. Yeah. Now, the
This was
Rapid
Omar
Support,
al-Bashir. Omar
this
al-Bashir
is
was
Omar
in there.
al-Bashir.
Got
Yeah,
it.
exactly. And then Sudan ranks second in Africa for the most military coups. Yeah, I think Burkina Faso ranks first. So, of course, when you're the general in a country that has the most military coups, you're going to be a bit paranoid that there'll be a military coup against you. Natural. Yeah. So he thinks it's a smart idea to beef up the rapid support forces, professionalize them, and use them as a kind of private militia that will protect him from any future coups. Yeah. Under the guise that, okay, they won't dare coup against me because I've got this militia. So the name Hemeti, the leader of the Rapid Support Forces, his name is Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. But he, people say, AKA Hemeti. Hemeti is a nickname given to him by Bashir, which means my protector, which means my protector. Yeah. So Bashir saw Hemeti as his private protector. And then the problem is now the South Sudanese separated from the North. The abundance of money that Bashir had on his disposal to keep these people wealthy, to keep these generals loyal to him, was massively decreased.
Wait,
So,
let's clarify this just a little bit.
sure.
In 2011, there was a referendum finally in South Sudan after a big campaign to save Darfur, which actually didn't become part of South Sudan, but there was a big campaign to protect the people of the South. There was a referendum in 2011, and al-Bashir was cut off from the most oil-rich regions in the South. So there was,
Yes.
you're explaining that. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, and key bit of context, 70% of the oil that existed in Sudan was in South Sudan. And it was actually found by Chevron, I think, in the late 1980s. And from that period onwards, the US was determined to separate South Sudan from the North, especially because Sudan, when it was a republic, had signed so many oil deals with China. So they believe that, okay, if we separate the South from the North, you have to renegotiate new deals. We
Oh, I
renegotiate.
see.
You renegotiate those new deals with us. So a lot of the money that he would use to buy the loyalty of his generals and to buy the loyalty of militia was no longer accessible to him. He still had some, but it was significantly reduced, which also led to the economic crisis, which led to his downfall. But what he started to do was he started to try buy Hemeti's loyalty by giving him the biggest gold mines in Darfur. Yeah. So he gave him the biggest gold mines in Darfur. And then he also allowed his militia to moonlight for other African nations. This is before it's kind of turned into the Rapid Support Forces. We started to see their involvement in the Central African Republic. So they were part of the Seleka force that basically invaded the Central African Republic from the north and caused the first recorded inter-religious conflict that the country's ever had. So this is a country that has had Christians and Muslims living side by side, never had inter-religious conflict until the Janjaweed joined the Seleka and invaded from the north. It participated in the war, the Libya civil war post-Gaddafi, backing General Khalifa Haftar. There was something in Chad as well, participation in Chad, protection of some sort of economic interest there. So it started to moonlight for other African nations.
Okay, so it was basically evolving into a mercenary force selling its services all over Africa.
Yes. And
Like
the
that.
reason why Bashir wanted them to do that is because he thought it's a lot cheaper for these guys to go out there and make money independently of me than me continue to fund them. And if I miss payments, then they might go off and do other things. And then when I need them, the militia force, which was 80, 90, 100,000, might be very small. So he thought if they moonlight in other conflicts, then these guys can stay battlefield ready and motivated. Yeah.
One love, Africa. Let's unite. One love. Sudan, don't, no, 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 no.
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Here's more from my conversation about Sudan with Sovereign Media editor Ahmed Caballo.
Then came the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Yeah? So 2015, I believe it was, Mohammed bin Salman, one of the first things he did was engage in this war with the UAE to try and take out...
Wait, he's the king of Saudi Arabia.
He's not technically the king, he's the crown prince, but because the king is mentally not with it anymore, I think he suffers from like Alzheimer's and stuff, he's the de facto king. So yeah, Mohammed bin Salman engages in this war, the Saudi-led war on Yemen, with the support of the United States and the United Kingdom, yeah? The reason why the United States and the United Kingdom wanted to take out the Houthi Ansar of Allah is because they thought they were Iran-aligned. So they didn't like the idea of what sectarian people call the Shia axis growing, what anti-imperialists call the resistance axis growing, yeah? And Yemen, which I believe is the largest Arab country, falling to the hands of an anti-imperialist government would be detrimental, is what they saw. Yeah, so they engaged in this Saudi-led war in Yemen, but they had a problem. They wanted to fight the Houthis, but they didn't want to put the lives of Emirati or Saudi soldiers in harm's way. So they have this agreement with Bashir. We know that you've been trying to have rapprochement with the West for a long time now. We can help you. We've got Washington's ear. We've got London's ear. We can help you. But you need to help us. We need foot soldiers for this war. So we will provide the air support, but we need your soldiers to fight. Yeah. So what does Bashir do? He says, no problem. I'm going to send the Sudanese army and I'm going to send the rapid support forces. So that's where the relationship between Hemeti and the UAE began. Yeah. Because how it's described is, as the war began in Yemen, there started to be a divergence between Saudi and UAE. They both want the Houthis gone, but they have different interests, different groups that they're supporting. So they say that Burhan, who was in Yemen, was answerable to the Saudis, and then Hemeti was answerable to the UAE. How true that is, who knows? But definitely, Hemeti had started to form his relationship with the UAE then. So then the war happens. It's not successful in its aims. There's a kind of like a peace agreement. And the rapprochement that was promised to Bashir wasn't really fulfilled, although there's an argument that it was fulfilled. But the US said to them, the military can stay in place, but the figurehead needs to go. And that's what the coup was. So anyway, because of the lack of money accessible to Bashir, there was a series of economic crises. Yeah. The first one, I think, began in 2014. Again, it was based on a budget. People were seeing subsidies being scrapped, but they were seeing the military budget was taking up a significant amount of the national budget. So like, okay, so we're scrapping subsidies, but yet the military budget stays the same.
Yeah.
Of course, the military budget stays the same because he wants to keep these guys loyal. Then again, 2018 was more of the same. It was just more extreme. So now stripping back of bread subsidies, which is always a mistake because bread is a staple part of the diet in Sudan, and fuel subsidies, and that caused more protest. And the protest just kept going until the military leadership were like, listen, we need to get rid of this guy, otherwise we're all in trouble. So
get rid of Omar al-Bashir.
Yeah, Omar al-Bashir. So they do a coup against Bashir. The coup, behind the coup is allegedly Hemeti and Burhan. So Hemeti, the protector of Bashir, doesn't protect him. There's a coup. Then then the military tries to take one of Bashir's right-hand men, a guy called Awad Ibn Auf, and go, okay, well, this guy is going to be the new leader through the transitional period. But the people weren't having it. So they were like, no, you guys are not going to fool us. You're not going to change the general's clothes and tell us that the general's gone. So they do a sitting outside the military HQ.
Is this where they were chanting civilian rule, civilian rule, civilian rule?
Medania, which means like civilian rule. So they did a sitting outside the military HQ. Awad Ibn Auf resigns and the people are like, yep. But then he gets replaced by Burhan. Yeah. And people are like, no, we're not having any of Bashir's generals in charge. We want civilian rule now. Then, because the sitting is going on for so long, the military gets the RSF to clear the military HQ. How do they clear the military HQ? What's called the June the 3rd massacre. which happened during Ramadan, June the 3rd, 2019, where 129 civilians were killed. Some of them dropped in the River Nile. A lot of women raped, some men raped. So I say all that to say the military and RSF were working together right until 2019. And then the civilian government, obviously, after the June 3rd massacre, the military HQ was cleared, internet was cut off, people were scared, etc. And then they agreed, which I think was kind of suicidal, to a power sharing agreement. Civilians and the military would share power during the transitional period. I say transitional because it was obviously never going to lead to a civilian government. And then there would be civilian rule. But what's critical here is they had a sovereign council. The head of the sovereign council was Burhan. Who did he make as his deputy? Take a guess. Yeah,
Committee.
exactly. So he made Hemeti the deputy of the sovereign council. And then during the transitional period, they agreed to the military would rule for 2 years, and then the civilians would rule for the next 2 years. And then after that 4 year of transition, there'd be elections. Now, during those 2 years of the military ruling, of course, they did a coup and removed all of the civilians. But the coup again in October 2021 was Hemeti and Burhan removing the civilian prime minister, Hamdok, and dismissing all the civilian members of the Sovereign Council. So again, they're working with each other till 2021. However, there was one bit during the transitional period that was a brave act by the civilian aspect. They set up a commission, because the thing about military dictatorships that people that don't live in military dictatorships don't quite understand is it's not just you're ruled by the military. The economy is controlled by the military. Yeah. Imports, exports, automobiles, agriculture, farming, all of this is controlled by the military. And then the gold exports was controlled by Hemeti and the militia. So they were like, we need to dismantle this. But to dismantle this, we need to do an inquiry to find out just how tight the grip is on our economy by these Bashir era elements. So when they did that, obviously that's when the coup happened in October 2021, when I started messing with their money. And then basically moving forward to
They
2023.
started saying basically these should be national resources, not the resources controlled by these generals for their own profit.
Exactly. And then 2023 happens. There was always a discussion about we need to incorporate the militia into the army. We can't have an army of 150,000 in a country and a militia of 100,000 in a country, probably more than that. We need to figure out a way to incorporate this militia into the army. What they probably was
Basically, Al
unaware.
Burhan. That's what Al Burhan said.
Yeah, that's what Al-Burhan said. But what he didn't realize is, or maybe he did realize, that's why he said it, is that by this point, Hemeti was deep, 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 deep in the pockets of the UAE. Yeah. And the UAE, I think it tried to reach an agreement with the Sudanese army on port access. And I don't think they like the response of the Sudanese army. So they've got this policy, which we see, where they have one man like Khalifa Haftar in Libya, and they're like, we'll back this guy to the hilt. Yeah. This guy will secure our interest in this country. So when he tried to, the proposal was, we need to incorporate the RSF within the army. I can't remember the time frame. It might have been within 5 years or 3 years. And then Hemeti's response was, no, 10 years. Obviously, if you're saying 10 years, you're kicking it into the long grass for it not to happen. And so there's different reports about how the fighting started in April 2023. The army says the RSF started to take offensive positions. The RSF says the army started to take offensive positions against the RSF. Who knows? What we do know is the RSF were buying up properties in key military positions in Khartoum. So it seems like they were gearing up for this for a while. So then the conflict starts. So that's why at the beginning, people didn't want to talk about it because it was so complicated. The army had been with the RSF for so long. Now the RSF is fighting the army. But what's happened since then, it's now, in the eyes of many Sudanese people, morphed into a new national liberation fight, because we now have a Gulf Arab monarchy trying to take control of the ports of Sudan, trying to take control of the gold mines in Sudan, and trying to take control of the agricultural land in a place called Al Jazeera in Sudan.
Right.
If they can't get control of all three, they will settle with the partition of Sudan, which is what we're seeing now. So we're seeing the RSF consolidate more places in the west and the southwest of the country, attempting to reach some sort of peace deal, which will lead in the partition of the country. Of course, Sudanese people can't have that. The RSF is not fit to govern. The places where the RSF was governing, and I speak from personal experience because my dad was under RSF occupation for 7.5 months, and it was horrendous. We can't abandon the people of Darfur. We can't abandon the people of West Kordofan, of South Kordofan, to RSF rule. So that's why all Sudanese people are now, despite their very problematic history, despite their history of coups, are supporting the Sudanese army against the RSF. And the example I'll give, and I'll just finish on this point, is it's almost like I tried to explain the situation like in Syria. People used to say to me, "So what, you back Assad?" I was like, "No, I don't back Assad. But if the situation was to happen in Sudan and the CIA and the Pentagon had funded to the tune of $1 billion foreign fighters to try take over Sudan, I would back Omar al-Bashir." Yeah, because it's a question of national sovereignty,
Poverty,
of territorial integrity. Yeah, so it doesn't mean that we think the Sudanese armies are angel, but every country in the world needs an army. Yeah, every country in the world needs an army. Once the RSF is defeated, then we need to depoliticize the army and send the army back to the barracks. And that's another battle. But in the short term, we're facing the very question of whether Sudan will exist as a state depends on the RSF being defeated. Yeah. And the very reason that my family are going to be able to go back to their homes, my dad's like 76 years old. He doesn't want to live in Birmingham. He wants to live in Sudan. He wants to be in Sudan. The only way that can happen is if the RSF is defeated.
Yeah, and this would be the second partition of Sudan. And every time it's partitioned, but first there was South Sudan, this would be the second partition. It gets weaker and weaker with each partition. When you have a larger state, it can use its various strengths to work together to become a stronger state. If it's a smaller state, it's more vulnerable to foreign resource extraction.
Exactly. South Sudan, when it became independent, had no debt. Now it's riddled with debt. They're closing some of their embassies because they can't pay the bills. It's now the see people when I said this before, and a few South Sudanese people got offended, and I don't mean to offend them at all, because their grievances against the North were legitimate, were 100% legitimate. But because you've got legitimate grievances, partition isn't necessarily the solution. Since the partition of Sudan and South Sudan, Sudan is now the world's worst humanitarian crisis. South Sudan is the world's poorest country. Sudan is in a proxy war. South Sudan has had two civil wars. It's in its second one right now. It's like, what has it served? What benefit has it given to Sudan? What benefit has it given to South Sudan? And if you have a corrupt military dictatorship like Omar al-Bashir, the answer isn't partition. It's uniting and getting rid of the military dictatorship and building a new country that benefits everyone. Yeah,
I think that's
if every time there's a problem in a country, we just partitioned ourselves, then we're just causing more problems, not less.
Yeah, that's what seems to be going on. There are a lot of impulses like that in Ethiopia, where you have many ethnicities and there's constant secessionist tension. But it would obviously be stronger staying together. The smaller states would be more vulnerable.
That was from Sudan, Songs of the Revolution, which were recorded during the 2019 street protest in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, after the ouster of Omar al-Bashir. The protesters were demanding civilian rule. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Here's more from my conversation about Sudan with Sovereign Media editor Ahmed Caballo.
So you see the SAF and al-Burhan now as representing sovereignty. The goal is to defeat the RSF, to defeat the partition, to defeat the UAE's land grabbing through the RSF, land and resource grabbing. Oh, and by the way, I was reading headlines yesterday and it said that the RSF had taken some new territory. It was oil-rich territory, and they had come in with engineers.
Yeah, crazy. Khalig is, it's in the south of West Kordofan State, and it's on the border of Abyei, which is the disputed territory between North and South Sudan. So it's one of the most oil-rich parts of the whole of Sudan. But yeah, it's crazy. And now they're all negotiating. South Sudan's negotiating, SAF's negotiating, and RSF is negotiating to a settlement on this in this oil-rich region. Now, it's hilarious that they can negotiate when it comes to a part of land that has oil in there, but trying to find an agreement in the rest of the country is like not even up for discussion at the moment. To be fair, the Sudanese army walked away from the peace negotiations in Washington for very legitimate reasons, and we can get into that if you want to get into it as well.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to talk about the Quad and the negotiations and about the imperialist interests here. I'd also like to talk about these identifications, Black, Arab, non-Arab, Arab. When people write about this and try to find a way to talk about it, they use all kinds of variable descriptions. And I know that they all have histories and they're all problematic. When I was reading Sovereign Media today, I was reading an article that was talking about Black African, Black African and Arab.
So we've moved away from the terminology Black, because almost everyone in Sudan is Black.
If we're if we're being descriptive, nobody's Black. You know, I'm brown.
But
by how the political term Black, almost everyone in Sudan is Black. Not everyone in Sudan would identify as African, and not everyone in Sudan would identify as Arab. But these are relics of colonialism, the Ottoman period, which really started it, and then the British, which entrenched it and used it as a way to administrate the country.
Which of these terms are helpful? What's the most helpful way to talk about this?
African and Arab is probably the simplest way. It's still problematic, but it's the best bit we've got, because there are tribes that identify as Arab, and then by definition, there are tribes that identify as African, which is strange because Sudan exists in Africa. So therefore,
geographically,
all the tribes are African. But yeah, they basically mean closer genealogy to Bantu tribes when they say African.
Yeah, you
know, they mean harder hair, certain features, etc. But yeah, it's a very complicated topic. I can try my best. I'll just start with this. Arab identity is not really a thing anyway, if we're being honest. Arab is a linguistic signifier. People that speak Arabic. People that speak Arabic. So the whole thing is a social construct. The whole thing is a social construct. Of course, race itself is a social construct. But within that, this whole idea of an Arab identity is a social construct. And now, I said that before, and there was someone in the comments saying, yes, but there are some Sudanese family that might have a Yemeni granddad or Yemeni great-great-granddad. And that is true. But let me ask you this. There might be a Yemeni family that has a great-great-granddad that's from Sudan, or from, but they don't call themselves African. So it's all about proximity to a power. So there's always a rush to identify with a group that's more powerful than yours. Like we see a similar thing in Jamaica. My Jamaica friends tell me all the time that there's always an exaggeration of Indian ancestry. Of course, Jamaicans have some Indian ancestry, but they'll love to tell you, I've got coolie hair, my hair is soft because I've got Indian ancestry. Anything but to identify as African. But by and large, all Sudanese people, if you check their genealogy, they're majority African. Some might have some Arab ancestry, some will have less, but by and large, they're African ancestry. So where does this start from? It starts from...
Wait a second. There's one other description I hear, which is Black Arab. Probably.
I mean, that is a way to say they're not, when you say Arab, then they're not going to look like they're from West Asia, what they call the Middle
Okay.
East. That's why they call
Okay.
them Black Arab, because people are like, what, this guy's Arab? He doesn't look Arab. He looks black. Oh, he's a Black Arab. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I interrupted you. Go. You were
no,
going to
no,
go
no, it's fine. It's fine. So I did my dissertation on this topic. So I only wrote from the period of the Ottomans. Now, people have told me since I've said this online that it starts before that. But I'm not going to talk about periods that I've not researched. Yeah, I'll just talk about
okay.
the bits that I know well.
Uh-huh.
So during a period called the Turkiyya, which is when the Ottomans and the Egyptians ruled over Sudan, which is around the mid-19th century, there was a viceroy who from Albania, who was a viceroy for the Ottoman Empire. He was ruling over Egypt, and then he was really obsessed about invading and going south to Sudan. And he had this racist Orientalist idea that he wants to get himself an all-black slave army. Yeah. And then the people were telling him, if you want to go to get yourself a black slave army, the blackest people in the world come from South Sudan. Yeah. In fact, Sudan, the name Sudan, it used to be called Belad al-Sudan, means the land of the blacks. Yeah. Sud means black in Arabic. So then it became, a lot of Muslims tried to deny this. No, the Turks didn't have colonialism, Ottoman Empire, but they did. So initially, they implemented taxes and also slavery. But so how it worked was, initially it was those that are non-Muslim could be enslaved.
Uh-huh.
Those that are non-Muslim could be taxed. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then it was, we're not getting enough tax and we don't have enough slaves. So now it was those that are non-Arab could be enslaved and those that are non-Arab could be taxed. So of course, as a way of survival, there becomes an over-identification of Arab identity. My great-great-grandmother is from Yemen. My great-great-great-uncle is from... So everybody and their dog wants to identify as Arab, yeah? And then this is a legacy that continues in the post-colonial state, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So much so, right until before the war, people who are darker skinned and have more Bantu features would be called slaves, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Even if they weren't enslaved. Because
okay.
anyone that is of African ancestry, not African ancestry, that's the wrong way of putting it, phenotype looked like they came from the Bantu regions of Africa, were constantly called slaves. So much so that I'm told, I probably shouldn't say this story publicly, but here we are, that when my mom and dad were about to get married, one of my mom's uncles was like, why is she marrying this Abid, yeah, which means slave, because my dad's family has its roots in Darfur, yeah?
Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to explain that this is a legacy that has never, ever been addressed, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Then the British came in, saw these distinctions within the society, and used that for administrative purposes, yeah? So they were like, okay, so the Arabs are primarily in the north, the non-Arabs are in the south. Let's separate it. They created something called the Southern Policy, where they created kind of the boundaries of what we call South Sudan today. Those from the south can't go north. Those from the north can't go south.
Okay.
They administrated the north in Arabic, the south in English. Public holidays in the south will be on a Sunday. As we flood the south with Christian missionaries, public holidays in the north will be on a Friday, et cetera, et cetera. Creating the divisions that would lay the foundations for two long bloody civil wars and then eventually the partition. So then what happens in places like Darfur is I kind of compare this to the rednecks in the US.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
So you find the most racist people are dirt poor white in the south of the US. Yeah. Is that a fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
overtly,
yeah.
Overtly racist. Yeah.
Overtly, yeah. I'll say overtly because real racism is institutional. It's not what people say.
Of course, we've got this president.
Of course, of course. But he very much talks like a redneck.
He does.
But a lot of that comes from the idea of I've been sold this illusion that being white means that I should be privileged. Yeah. But I'm not privileged, poor. I'm living in a trailer, etc., etc. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the same thing in Darfur. Some of these Arab nomadic tribes are some of the most, economically speaking, marginalized group, but they've still been fed 2 centuries worth of the Arabs are superior to the non-Arabs. The Arabs, Sudan belongs to the Arabs. These people are slaves, etc., etc. So there's a resentment in the fact of we have these settled communities that are doing
not well compared to Khartoum, but well compared to some of these nomadic Arab tribes through farming. And we've got nothing. Why is that? Yeah. So this has been started from the 80s. This resentment is growing and growing and growing. And Bashir's administration obviously knew this and played into this. Yeah. And all of the places where there was rebellions against the capital city, all of them come from places which are majority African tribes. So the Nuba Mountains, the Blue Nile, South Sudan, Darfur. So that's the racial element, yeah? Because these places are underdeveloped, and a way to justify not addressing the underdevelopment is to be playing to kind of racist tensions that exist there, use the racism that exists in Khartoum and the surrounding areas to dismiss the very legitimate grievances that people have in popular culture, racist caricatures of people from South Sudan, of the Nuba Mountains, all this type of stuff. So it was always going to implode. Yeah. It wasn't sustainable having this racially divided country where all of the wealth is concentrated in kind of one area. It was always going to explode. And so the RSF is kind of like the Frankenstein monster that was created by SAF that has
I
now
see.
turned back, gone back up the village, gone back up the mountains, attacked the evil scientist, which is the Sudanese military.
And so we're talking about genocide. People, you're talking about genocide. Who are the victims of genocide in these descriptions, and who are the perpetrators? Perpetrators being the RSF, but who are the victims?
So the best way to describe it is the RSF, the Janjaweed, which formed into the RSF, were committing genocide in 2003. Yeah. They were given weapons, port, logistical support by the Sudanese army, and they were attempting to clear the land of these African tribes once and for all, so that land is theirs. Now, under the war with the Sudanese army, they're trying to finish the job that they didn't finish in 2003. So it's primarily some of the Arab tribes that joined the Janjaweed in 2003 versus some of the African tribes before the Masailli, etc. But they literally asked them, because this is how silly it is. If it was so easy to identify who is who's not, you wouldn't need to ask them what tribe they're from. Yeah. So we see so many videos where they go, "What tribe are you from?" And they say, and then they start shooting them. Yeah. So they're trying to cleanse the land, but also cleanse the land to once and for all monopolize that grazing land that historically they're being pushed away from.
Okay. I wish this is something, frankly, that the National Basketball Association would understand. You have a sport that is 70% what we call black in the United States. The UAE has purchased it, put its name all over its basketball arenas, the Experience Abu Dhabi on the jerseys of the New York Knicks. And you would think that these, or is what we call in America, black players would care about a genocide in Africa, particularly in the darker skinned populations of Sudan that has this racial component to it.
Yeah, I mean that's the American model in general. You distract people with money, cars, materialism, and they don't look outside. They're like, "Well, things are great in my house. Why the hell would I pay attention to what's going outside of my house?" That's the way that the revolutionary movement has been co-opted all of the luxuries so that they can forget about what's going on outside of their own direct family. And it is sad. And you can add Congo to that because one of the biggest sponsors of the NBA is Rwanda, who
Rwanda,
are
yeah,
those.
exactly.
Yeah.
Even though the ESPN did a documentary called How the NBA Got Into Bed with a Dictator, it didn't stop the LA Clippers and the LA Rams from selling these sponsorships. These sports teams, and especially the NBA, are very vocal about aggression towards Black people in the United States. Like they all come out with their Black Lives Matter t-shirts when those were going to the Black Lives Matter jerseys. They're always wearing MLK jerseys on MLK Day. It just doesn't expand to the Black world internationally.
Sure. And one of the greatest examples of that, it's not in the NBA, but the rapper Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar, due to very effective PR, has positioned himself as the poster boy for what they call conscious rap. Yeah. He made all these songs talking about the black of the berry and all this type of stuff, talking about racism and using Malcolm X speeches and Tupac speeches, all this type of stuff, forgetting that Tupac comes from the Black Panther family. And his godmother was in Cuba and all this type of stuff. It was always international. But he went and performed in Kigali, in Rwanda. Paul Kagame goes on stage, greets him. He has the Africa map in the background. So there's a lot of this performative radicalism, and it needs to be called out, because that's not where the people that these guys held up, like the Malcolm X's and the Huey P. Newton's, they all had an international lens, every single one of them. But yet you're claiming these guys are your heroes, and that you read the autobiography of Malcolm X and Asata Speaks and Revolutionary Suicide. You claim to have read all these books, but you seem to miss the main point. And there's the famous speech from Malcolm, where I think he might have been talking about the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And then someone heckles him from the crowd and goes, "We're not here to talk about Congo." And then Malcolm responds and goes, "We're not here to talk about Congo. We're here to talk about Mississippi." And Malcolm's response is, "We won't sort out what's going on in Mississippi until we sort out what's going on in Congo." And the point is, the reason why you get instances of racism in the US, in the UK, against black minority more than any other group, is because Africa is weak. Africa is exploited.
Yes.
Unless you improve the position of Africa on the global stage, of African people on the global stage, then we're always going to be the target of racism, discrimination, marginalization, institutional racism, and so on.
That was the first 50 minutes of an hour and a half long interview with Sudanese scholar and journalist Ahmed Caballo, editor of Sovereign Media, sovereignmedia.online. The rest can be found on Black Agenda Report's YouTube channel by searching for the headline, "Struggling for Sovereignty, Sudan After 2 Years of Civil War."
Freedom! One love, one heart, one destiny, Sudan. One love, one heart, one destiny, Sudan. One love, one heart, one destiny, Sudan. One love. I sit down and I pray, pray that my people see the light one day. Love to the south, I'll be on my way. Mashi fi tariq ma batrajae. Justice is what we fight for. Pray that my people see the light one day. Love to the north, I'll be on my way. Mashi fi tariq ma batrajae. One love, one heart, one destiny, Sudan.
That was the Sudanese pop song, One Love Sudan. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Polina Basilia and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. Merry Christmas, and thanks for listening.